This podcast includes descriptions of violence and death. Please take care while listening. It's March 3rd, 2020, around 11 p.m. Manny Ellis, a 33-year-old black man living in Tacoma's South End neighborhood, is walking to a nearby 7-Eleven. It's part of his nightly routine. He's wearing bright yellow sweatpants, white sneakers, and a dark hoodie. Manny buys some raspberry-filled powdered donuts and a jug of water, and he heads back home. On his way, he's stopped by a Tacoma police officer at the intersection of 96 and Ainsworth.
And I said, hey, come over here. What's going on?
The officer wants to know what Manny's doing. It's about 11:20 p.m.
Hitting him! Just arrest him! Just arrest him!
Henry 317.
Oh my god, that looks so scary!
27. I'm not 6 and dangerous.
Can't breathe, sir. Can't breathe!
Yes. Sorry, traffic, Henry 317, unknown trouble, 96 and 8, where can I switch my shield?
He's gonna have to be trapped now.
By 11:34, paramedics are on scene. They have to start breathing for Manny. A few minutes later, they start CPR on him, but they're unsuccessful. And Manny is declared dead on the street just after midnight. From KNKX Public Radio and the Seattle Times, this is The Walk Home. I'm KNKX Special Projects reporter Maiwa Aina. The officers involved in Manny's death say when they encountered Manny that night, he was aggressive. He attacked them. They initially said his death probably had something to do with excited delirium, which is something police say can happen when someone is on drugs and starts fighting officers with superhuman strength, then overheats and suddenly dies. To the officers, their use of force to get Manny under control was clear and appropriate. But months later, eyewitnesses and video footage surfaced that contradicted the officers' version of events. Eyewitnesses say Manny did nothing wrong and that the officers were the aggressors. In the midst of the racial justice protests of 2020, and after public outcry and multiple investigations, the state of Washington charged Tacoma police officers Matthew Collins, Christopher Shane Burbank, and Timothy Rankin with the murder and manslaughter of Manny Ellis. Washington's Attorney General's office says this is the first time it has criminally charged police officers for the unlawful use of deadly force. The officers have been on trial for more than 9 weeks. Eyewitnesses, medical experts, and the officers themselves told different stories to the jury about what happened in the last hour of Manny's life. And now the verdict in this historic trial is in the hands of the jury, and they will have to decide which story to believe. On this episode, we bring you key moments from the trial while we wait to hear what the jury decides. We're going to do it in two parts. In part one, we walk through the eyewitness testimony and hear the officers tell their side of the story when they take the stand in their own defense. The witnesses in this trial fall into three broad categories: eyewitnesses, expert witnesses, and law enforcement. I want to start with the eyewitnesses. One of the major questions has been, how did the interaction between Manny and the officers start? Why did they stop him? Three people say they saw the very beginning of the interaction. They say the officers attacked Manny, unprovoked. Three other people say they saw the struggle happen and that Manny never fought back. The first eyewitness I want to talk about is Seth Cowden. He's 22 years old. He was called by the state. Cowden was delivering pizzas that night. He says he saw the officer's patrol car come to a stop at the light at the intersection.
I saw the vehicle slowly cruising by. It was traveling at a mere just like 1 or 2 miles an hour. Right behind the vehicle is where I noticed a man who we now know as Manuel Ellis. I saw him walking as well. It was right beside the police vehicle. What I observed next was Manuel Ellis was basically walking down the street. I saw him turn around as if he was responding to some sort of call. I could not tell if the windows of the police vehicle were down or if an officer was yelling for the man walking on the road.
He says about 10 seconds into the interaction, it looked like Manny got knocked down by the patrol car door.
But I couldn't have seen if it actually knocked Manuel Ellis down, but that is what I basically perceived. I saw Manuel Ellis walking, and I only saw the top part of his body because the police vehicle was blocking my view. And then I simply saw him go out of my view. And then I believe I saw the top of the door of the passenger side of that vehicle open.
Cowden captured what happened next on video. There's no sound from his video, but his video shows Manny being shocked with a taser and pulled to the ground. The state shows the video synced up with video and audio from other angles captured that night, and they play it for the jury. Officers Burbank and Collins are on top of Manny, and Manny's legs flail around while he's held down on his stomach.
Honestly, it was, I would say, human nature, but it was in my nature to simply record it, if anything, to just show people, because I don't think anyone would have believed me.
Sarah McDowell also testified for the state. She's 26. 3 years ago, she was driving down the same street as the officers and came to a stop behind their patrol car. McDowell's ex-boyfriend was in a separate car right behind her with their kids. She says the light turned green, but the officers didn't move. It looked like one of the officers got Manny's attention, and she noticed Manny walk on the sidewalk over to the patrol car.
It just looked like he was having a conversation with the officers. And then he, went to turn around. What I thought, he was going back to the sidewalk. And then the passenger officer opened his door. He was close enough for him to get knocked down to his knees. And then the passenger jumped out. And then the driver officer flicked his lights on, the yellow lights, ran around the front of the car, and then it all started.
McDowell got out of her car and captured video of what happened next.
Stop! Oh my God, stop hitting him! Hitting him, just arrest him! Just arrest him! Oh my God, that looks so scary!
In the video, it looks like Manny is thrown to the ground in the first couple of seconds. As he hits the pavement, one of the officers looks like he's throwing punches. You can see Manny's legs, his bright yellow sweatpants and white sneakers, swinging wildly in the air. The video ends with Manny on the ground. The officers are on top of him, telling him to put his hands behind his back. The video is played for the jury.
I hit record because I didn't want them to keep hitting him and hurting him, and I just wanted them to arrest him. What they were doing wasn't right to me. I wanted to make sure that whatever happened was on tape. It wasn't right. I've never seen that happen before. I've never seen a cop do that to anybody. And so it was the worst thing I've ever seen. It was scary. It wasn't okay.
McDowell's ex-boyfriend, Keon Lowry, was with her at the intersection. He's a third eyewitness, and he backs up McDowell's testimony. He testified that when he saw the interaction between Manny and the officers, he got out of his car and started yelling at the officers, too. He can be heard on the doorbell camera footage, yelling at the officers that they were, quote, in the wrong.
Oh my God, that looks so scary!
Hey, y'all in the wrong right now!
The state called another witness, a fourth one, Ayanna Malang. She's 28. She lives in the house that captured part of the encounter on the doorbell camera. She was home at the time, and also took two cell phone videos. She didn't see the beginning of the interaction between Manny and the officers, but she says she heard men yelling outside, and she looked out of her bedroom window.
The police officer was attempting to grab and physically restrain the man in the civilian clothing, and the man was twisting and pulling away from the police officer, asking the officer to stop. I looked away from the window and attempted to wake up my fiancé. While I was looking away from the window, I heard a woman's voice say something like, "Hey, what are you doing? Stop."
Malang describes walking around in her house, trying to get a better view of what was happening.
She tries a front window first, but the view is blocked by a pillar. So, she says, she goes back to her bedroom.
I could see the cop make a running kick towards the man who was still on the ground. And then I saw the cop lunge down and punch, and both the kick and the punch made contact with the man's body. I could hear the man pleading for the officer to stop. And then I heard a taser arc buzz. I could see the man on the ground with a police officer kneeled with his body on top of him. And the man was stating that he could not breathe.
She says she hears the taser again. And about a minute later, she sees two more officers run diagonally toward the scene. And then she says, about 30 to 45 seconds later, she sees a much larger police response. These witnesses say it didn't seem like Manny did anything to provoke the response from the officers. And when they were struggling, it wasn't an equally matched fight, because Manny never fought back. Defense attorneys suggested the witnesses may have been fuzzy on the details of an event that happened 3 years ago. Or maybe they weren't actually there from the very beginning to see what caused the officers to stop Manny. Or maybe they were too distracted to completely pay attention to what they were seeing. But all four eyewitnesses said no. They were clearly paying attention to what was happening in front of them, and they remembered it to this day. The officers' attorneys called eyewitnesses of their own, and they were highly anticipated. These witnesses had told detectives that they saw Manny throwing the officers around and manhandling them. Shad Hayes was staying at a house near the intersection. He says he noticed amber police lights were flickering outside his window for a while. He went to see what was happening and saw the officers struggling to subdue Manny.
And I'm a pretty fair-sized gentleman, and I've got military police experience training, and I just asked them if they needed help, and they said no, they had backup on.
Hayes told Pierce County Sheriff's detectives that he saw Manny, quote, throwing the officers around. But when defense attorney Wayne Fricke asks him about it, Hayes' response is a surprise.
They were struggling with him quite a bit. Yeah, they were in trouble subduing him at the time, yes.
Do you recall using those words, throwing him around pretty good?
I don't. No, I don't.
Would you refresh your recollection if you're able to see the report from the officers?
Well, I actually read the report that one detective. There was a few words in there that I don't agree with what you wrote down, but I don't remember ever saying to the guy, so.
He says he didn't say those words. Records show this witness, Shad Hayes, did in fact make those statements to a detective. The interview was recorded. But he kind of takes it back on the stand. Another defense lawyer, Ann Bremner, tries to get Hayes to say he saw Manny throwing the officers around.
But what I want to ask you about is, you said, I don't know if he was drunk or higher drugs on drugs or whatever, but he was, quote unquote, throwing him around pretty good.
I never said that to the detective about whether he's drunk or high on drugs. How would I know that?
No, that's okay, but I wasn't asking about that part. I was asking about whether the quoted part that I quoted to you, that Mr. Ellis was throwing the officers around pretty good.
Yeah, he was struggling with them. Yes, they were trying to subdue him. But at no time did I see him actually stand up, or did I see any blows struck. All I saw was they were struggling, trying to subdue him. That's the part I saw.
Would it be fair to say, Mr. Hayes, that Manny Ellis was throwing the officers around?
It looked to me like they were having a hard time subduing him. That's why I asked him if they needed help.
Throwing him around pretty good?
Yes, they were having a hard time subduing him.
I'm sorry, you said yes when I said
yes.
Throwing him around pretty good, you said
yes, they were having a hard time subduing him, yes.
Thank you.
It's hard to know, at this point, why he insisted that that wasn't true and that he didn't say those exact words. The defense attorneys called another witness, Kenneth Ashford White. He also lives in the house with the doorbell camera, the same one Ayanna Malang lives in. He's Ayanna Malang's brother. He watched from outside their home on his front porch as the officers tried to restrain Manny. He told detectives he saw Manny, quote, manhandling the officers. On the stand, he clarifies that he saw Manny bucking and lifting the officers off the ground when he was face down. He says that caught his attention because it would take a lot of strength.
Just being able to kind of push a police officer off of him is a little strong. I was in the prior service, and knowing that the Marine Corps sappy plate or body armor is about an extra 25 to 50 pounds, depending on the person. I know it takes a little bit of strength to be able to get someone to move off of you with that on.
But Ashford White says he never saw Manny throw any punches or kicks at the officers or really fight back. And neither did Shad Hayes. And neither of them saw the officers hit or kick Manny either. From their vantage point, it just looked like a struggle. They both said it looked like police had the situation under control by the time backup arrived. Six people in total, four from the state and two from the defense, testified to what they saw the night officers encountered Manny Ellis. None of them say they saw Manny fight back, strike, or kick at the officers. And a few directly contradicted what the officers say happened that night. Up next, the officers involved tell a different story, and they tell it to the jury in their own words. That's after the break.
Hi, I'm Flona Hala-Davila with KNKX Public Radio.
I'm Jonathan Martin with the Seattle Times.
And Jonathan, our newsrooms got to collaborate together a couple years ago on a podcast called Outsiders.
It was such a great experience for us, and that's what brought us back here for another collaboration with KNKX.
I think it really serves audiences better when newsrooms work together.
These collaborations are interesting and fun, but they're complex, which is why we need your support to do more of them.
And the way to support future collaborations like this is to donate to KNKX by going to knkx.org.
And to donate to the Seattle Times Investigative Journalism Fund at st.news/IJF.
And thanks.
We've been waiting for 3 years to hear more from the officers involved in Manny's death. About 20 or so officers from around the county responded to the scene that night. Three ended up facing criminal charges: Officer Matthew Collins, his partner, Christopher Shane Burbank, and their colleague, Timothy Rankin. We've only ever had a single statement from each of them, a recorded interview with Pierce County investigators in the days following Manny's death. After that, they never publicly said another word. They didn't answer any questions from state investigators. They did talk to the Tacoma Police Department's internal affairs, but none of those statements have been made public, and an internal review of the officer's conduct is on hold until the trial is over. Taking the stand as a defendant is a high-stakes decision. On one hand, you get to say your piece, and that could be a powerful gesture to the jury. Testifying could be humanizing, but you also have to face intense cross-examination by the prosecution, and you risk coming out looking far worse than when you started. Throughout the trial, the officers' legal teams said their clients were eager to tell their stories. The officers say Manny put them in a dangerous situation that spun completely out of control. They say he attacked them, and when he wouldn't stop, they needed to use more and more force to get him into restraints. I want to start with the officers with the most serious charges, Collins and Burbank. They're both white, and they're both facing second-degree murder and first-degree manslaughter charges. They were the first two officers to contact Manny, and they're the ones seen on multiple videos violently restraining him. Collins took the stand first.
Please state your name and please spell your name.
My name is Matthew Collins, MattHewCollins.
He was the driver of their two-man unit. Collins, a married father of four, spent almost 8 years in the military and was deployed for combat multiple times before joining the Tacoma Police Department in 2015. He tells the jury he knows Brazilian jiu-jitsu and wrestling and grappling. At the department, Collins trained other officers on defensive tactics.
It's just kind of what we call our hand-to-hand training at Tacoma. Largely, what we do is we teach, you know, cuffing, dealing with violent subjects.
He says he and his partner were responsible for patrolling one of the most dangerous areas of the city, the South End, the area where Manny lived. While on patrol, they would get dangerous calls every night.
There's a lot of shootings, prostitution, drugs is rampant. Domestic violence is probably the number one call we go to. A lot of times, unfortunately, drugs are involved in that as well.
He says the first priority in every situation is getting people into handcuffs. In their patrol area, they had to do it all the time.
The first thing we've got to do is stop you from hurting yourself, hurting someone in the community, or us, right? So we got to get you in handcuffs. So that's number one always.
Officer Collins and his partner Christopher Burbank were the first two officers to encounter Manny Ellis on the night Manny died, around 11 p.m. Collins says they were stopped at a light at the intersection of 96 and Ainsworth. His partner was in the passenger seat taking down notes from a previous call. Eyewitnesses say they saw Manny walking on the sidewalk on the passenger side of the patrol car. But Officer Collins says no. When he first saw Manny, Manny was standing in the middle of the intersection, closer to the driver's side of the patrol car. Manny was messing with a car on the road.
I didn't know, you know, was this a domestic violence thing where someone got kicked out of a car? Is this guy trying to get a ride? Is this, who knows, carjacking? Could be anything.
But then he says the car Manny was messing with drives around Manny and speeds off. And Manny stays in the intersection.
So now I have no victim. Now I have a guy standing in the street. So I call him over. And if he just ran away at that point, we would have just kept driving. We didn't really have anything. So then I rolled down my window and said, hey, man, what are you doing? He just immediately started jogging over to the car. I immediately knew something was wrong. His eyes were super wide, and he was, like, sweating profusely, and it was a cold night. And he says something like, I got to talk. I'm having a bad night. I got warrants. And I said, all right, man, calm down. Go sit on the sidewalk, and we'll call this out. You know, I'm super uncomfortable because he's right up on my window, and it just didn't seem right.
Colin says he was getting ready to check for any outstanding warrants when, instead of going to the curb, Manny turns toward the patrol car.
He just fixates on Officer Burbank, and the way he's looking, you know, part of being a police officer, we read people's body language and their eyes for a living. That's what we do, because one minute I can be talking to a person who just is having a bad day and you stopped on traffic, or someone who's trying to kill us. The range is huge. The way he was looking at Officer Burbank concerned me greatly. He starts looking at him through the glass, and then he's like strangely close to the car as he comes around the side. Now I don't know what's going to happen. And I'm watching him, and there's a brief interchange where they kind of say something, and then all of a sudden he starts punching the window.
He says punching the window amounts to felony assault on a police officer.
When someone initiates and you're sitting in a car or something like that, now they're in control. They've started this contact. They're dictating this contact. And so my first instinct is to take back control of that. So my first thought is get him down, get him in handcuffs, figure out what's going on.
Colin says he jumps out of the car to confront Manny.
So as soon as I get to the front of the vehicle, he takes his focus off of Burbank and comes right at me and grabs him by my vest and picks me up and throws me backwards into the intersection.
He says the moment Manny throws him, that's a second count of felony assault on a police officer.
Yeah, I think I landed like on my back, my neck, and I rolled backwards and got right back up.
Collins says he runs back at Manny, and when they make contact, Manny starts flailing around, and Manny hits him a few times. He says they fall to the ground, and he gets on top of Manny. He says he elbows him multiple times in the face to try to get him into handcuffs. He says elbow striking is a de-escalation tactic.
If you get elbowed in the face, you kind of turtle. You turn on your side and you protect yourself. And as soon as you do that, you put yourself in a perfect place for me to put two hands on one of your arms and start the cuffing process.
Collins is captured on video, elbow striking Manny in the face.
I've got to regain the initiative of this. I've got to get him on the defense. And like I said, ideally, he flips around, faces the ground, and then maybe we can start ending this right now. So instead, he just keeps swinging wildly, and he lunges up at me towards my face and basically is about to push me over.
Colin says he gets up and prepares to put Manny in an LVNR, or lateral vascular neck restraint. It's a move that looks like a headlock, where he wraps his arm around the person's neck, squeezing the arteries on both sides to constrict blood flow and make a person pass out. He says he does this because he doesn't want to keep hitting Manny. He demonstrates the restraint on his attorney for the jury.
We gotta put this guy out so we can get him in handcuffs.
This move is captured on video too. He says he tries to do the neck restraint, but he says he doesn't do it completely, and they're back on the ground. Then he says he sees his partner, Officer Burbank, getting ready to fire a taser at Manny. The taser strikes are captured on video, too.
And once I feel that taser stop his active resistance, I immediately transfer to his left arm. Now I'm just controlling his left arm. So now it's going to be Burbank's job to control the right arm, my arm, my job on the left arm. He was trying to stand up the whole time. He was trying to rip his arms apart. He was kind of kicking and spinning both directions, as you can see on the video. It's getting more and more serious. As these things go, we don't have the option to just say, okay, we're done. Have a nice night. This guy has to go. He's a danger to the public. He's a danger to himself and to us, right? So he has to go in cuffs. We could be progressing towards a lethal situation at this point where we're using firearm.
Collins says they finally get Manny into handcuffs, but Manny is still struggling, trying to stand up. Then he says backup arrives and other officers take over. He says he and Burbank step away from Manny. They go and catch their breath. And he says at that point, Manny was still alive. Under cross-examination, Special Prosecutor Patty Eakes questions Collins about inconsistencies in his statement and with other evidence, like that door check from his partner that at least two eyewitnesses say they saw.
And you never said anything in your statement and you didn't see Officer Burbank door check Mr. Ellis?
I did not.
So you never saw Mr. Ellis get hit by Officer Burbank's door?
I did not.
Collins says Manny threw him in the air.
You say that Mr. Ellis picked you up all the way off the ground, is that right?
He kind of like a shove backwards, and I left my feet and went back on my back in the middle of the intersection.
And you said that you literally were off your feet, correct?
That is correct.
And you would agree that if someone was there watching, they would have seen that, correct?
Yes, I'm assuming they would.
Would have been obvious to anybody who was watching?
If they were there, yes.
None of the eyewitnesses testified to seeing that. Not even his partner mentioned seeing that happen. Collins says he remembers the neighbor, Shad Hayes, coming out.
I recall Mr. Hayes asking us if we needed him to help us.
He even remembered what he looked like.
And you said that he was a big Caucasian male, bald head, and he just kind of came out and was like, are you guys all right? What's going on? Do you recall that?
Yes, I do.
But he says he never heard Sarah McDowell, the eyewitness who recorded this video.
Stop! Oh my God, stop hitting him!
They played it for him in court.
I didn't hear her yelling at us.
Collins says he was experiencing something called auditory exclusion. That's kind of like tunnel vision, but for your ears. In that high-stress situation, he says he couldn't hear everything that was going on around him.
I get very focused in those situations, and I was focused on his hands, and I was focusing on getting him in handcuffs, and I didn't hear any of that.
He denies other witness testimony about what's captured in the videos. He says the videos don't show what he and his partner were up against.
I'm not sure how, I mean, I see this with my eyes and I understand what you're describing, but that is not what's happening.
Special Prosecutor Patty Eakes shows him another video.
So, but he was swinging wildly. That's what you told Pierce County, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Would you agree that there's nothing in this video that shows Mr. Ellis swinging wildly at you?
Well, it's very hard to see what's going on. All I can see is the white of my hand as my arm goes up to strike him.
Can't see Mr. Ellis swinging wildly at you, can you, in that video?
I mean, you can't see much of anything in that. No, ma'am.
You would agree that it doesn't show him swinging wildly at you, correct?
I would agree that it doesn't show much of anything, like I said, ma'am.
Evidence in the trial indicates Manny said he couldn't breathe at least 5 times during his encounter with the officers. A doorbell camera, 112 feet away, captured it clearly. The footage and audio were played in court.
Can't breathe, sir. Can't breathe.
Yes, I never heard him say that.
Collins says he never heard Manny say any words at all, only animal noises. Someone is heard on the doorbell camera responding to Manny. Patty Eakes asks Collins about it.
Was that you who responded, shut the fuck up now?
Again, I don't remember saying that, but if it's only Officer Burbank and I there, then I would say that was me, yes.
He says his partner, Officer Burbank, generally doesn't curse.
And you can't recognize your own voice when you hear that now?
No, not from here.
All right, and you would agree that when you said that to Mr. Ellis, it was because he had said something to you, correct?
I mean, again, I don't remember saying it, but that would be the usual reason for a response.
Yeah, you wouldn't tell him to shut the fuck up unless he had said something to you, correct?
Or just talking in general when he's not complying and putting his hand behind his back like we're asking him to do.
So it's your testimony that even if it was just his non-compliance as opposed to saying something, you would tell him to shut the fuck up?
It's my testimony that if anything that someone would say to us until they're complying and putting their hands behind their back, would be irrelevant to me.
And Colin says, even if he had heard Manny say he couldn't breathe, he wouldn't have done anything differently.
To us, this was a very clear-cut situation. Tragic, but it was clear-cut. I didn't think in my wildest nightmares that the state would come after us for wrongdoing in this. I thought we were explaining a terrible, tragic situation that happened.
He says even though Manny's death was tragic, it was Manny who caused it. All Collins tried to do was get a dangerous person into handcuffs. Collins' partner, Officer Christopher Shane Burbank, also faces second-degree murder and first-degree manslaughter charges. He's the one who door-checks Manny with the patrol car door and tases Manny during the struggle. In his statement to detectives, he said he placed the hobbles around Manny's ankles, and he connected the hobbles to the handcuffs behind Manny's back to hogtie him. At trial, Burbank didn't offer any testimony to back up Collins' account of what happened. Burbank didn't offer any testimony to explain his state of mind or to share how the case has affected him. Burbank chose not to take the stand, and his attorneys didn't say why. This is the only time his voice is captured on the record during the trial.
Have you discussed this issue about whether you should testify or not with your lawyers?
Yes, I have, Your Honor.
Do you have any questions about any of that?
I have not.
Do you feel like you understand that your rights and you understand what the circumstances and what the consequences would be of your potentially failing to testify?
I do, Your Honor.
And compared it with your actually testifying?
Yes, Your Honor.
And having all of that in mind, is it your desire not to testify in this case?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Burbank's statement to Pierce County investigators can only be used against him. It can't be used against Officer Collins or Rankin. And part of the jury's instructions say Burbank's decision not to testify should not be viewed negatively or used to infer guilt. The next officers to arrive on the night Manny died were Officers Timothy Rankin and Masai Ford. They're partners. Rankin is Asian American. Ford is black. They arrived as backup and helped restrain Manny. Masai Ford was under investigation for about a year, but ultimately he isn't facing any charges in this trial, and the Tacoma Police Department cleared him of any wrongdoing. He was called to the stand as a witness.
My name is Masai Ford. It's M-A-S-Y-I-H, last name Ford, F-O-R-D.
Dressed in his Tacoma PD uniform, including his firearm, Ford testified that he and Rankin became partners in 2019 and friends. He says they would host potlucks together and do playdates for their dogs. He says they worked well together.
We'd make a felony arrest pretty much every night, and those are often dangerous, intense situations, and we always communicated very well as partners.
Ford says his partner, Officer Rankin, did nothing wrong the night Manny died. Officer Rankin's lawyer, Ann Bremner, asks him about it.
Did you see anything that looked to you to be inappropriate or excessive at that point in terms of what Officer Rankin was doing in attempting to restrain Mr. Ellis?
No. If I did, I would have immediately intervened. That's our job as partners, is to hold each other accountable. So if I had saw that, I would have immediately told him to stop.
And the whole time he was there, Ford says he never saw Manny punch, kick, or threaten any officers on scene. Mostly, he said, he was afraid that Manny could if he were to get out of his restraints. Ford's testimony backs up his partner's version of events. His partner, Timothy Rankin, is facing first-degree manslaughter charges. Rankin sat on Manny's back while trying to restrain him. There isn't much evidence against Rankin besides his own statement to investigators. He told them he heard Manny say he couldn't breathe, and he told Manny, if you're talking to me, you can breathe just fine. Of the three officers charged, Rankin is the officer that used the least amount of force, but he decided to testify in his own defense. He was the last witness to testify in the trial.
Thank you very much, sir. Have a seat right here. Please state your name and please spell your name.
First name, Timothy, T-I-M-O-T-H-Y. Last name, Rankin, R-A-N-K-I-N-E.
Rankin tells the jury he was born in Singapore and lived there until he was 13. He served in the military before joining the Tacoma Police Department in 2018. As a new officer, Rankin was fresh off a standard year-long probationary period on the night Manny died. Rankin says he and Ford were patrolling South Tacoma. Rankin was driving. He says they had passed by Collins and Burbank earlier that night as they were clearing a traffic stop. They backed them up.
I think Officer Collins was the one that gave me a thumbs up, and we stopped, and then we just kept going because they were about to clear that call.
A few minutes later, Rankin says he and Ford heard mic clicks come over the radio.
So the first one, usually we kind of disregard it, but this night, the mic clicks kept going. 3, 4, and then dispatch said, Henry 317, which is Officer Burbank and Officer Collins' call sign, and we just had backed them up on a traffic stop, and there was no response. The frequency of the mic clicks, as a new officer, it signified someone was trying to go for their hand mic to call something out, but they are unable to. So Officer Ford and I think we thought the worst.
He says he heard Officer Burbank scream out his location. He flipped a U-turn and started racing toward them. As they approached, he says he could see Officer Collins and Burbank's patrol car in the street. As a new officer, he says the scene they arrived at was concerning.
Officer Burbank, he was my training officer, so both of them are like the go-to two-man car in the South End. Everyone wanted to be like them, so when me and Ford partner up, we tried to mimic ourselves as best we could to them because there was nothing they couldn't do. They handled every single call very well. They were very professional. The only way I could describe it is literally watching Mr. Alice buck back and forth. And Officer Burbank looked like he was just riding a wild horse.
He says he saw Manny on his stomach with the officers on top of him, and Manny was thrashing around.
So the first thing I thought about was, we got to get this guy in cuffs.
Rankin says he and Burbank made a plan to try and control Manny's arms, while Collins and Ford tried to control his legs.
After we made our plan, Officer Burbank, I see him start to get off Mr. Alice, like the way he was positioned in Mr. Alice. And then I see Mr. Alice just kind of buck his chest up. And then the next thing I see is Officer Burbank goes tumbling into the street. And that's at the point in time where I had to move myself on top of Mr. Alice.
He stepped off the stand to demonstrate how he got on top of Manny.
Mr. Alice was thrashing around pretty violently. He was trying to lift me off the ground. And I remember looking down at him, and he turned his head to his left, and he said, "I can't breathe," but in a very calm, like everyday kind of conversation voice. Till that time, the only thing I've heard Mr. Ellis say was absolutely nothing. All I heard him do say is make, I think the way I describe it is like animalistic noises, like just grunting a lot. And that to me sounded like just a lot of that since the time I got there. So when he said I can't breathe the first time, I think in my head, the first thing I was a bit confused. I think in my head, I didn't say it out loud, but I was just thinking, who said it and what is happening kind of deal. And then he said it again, and that's when I noticed it was actually Mr. Alice that said it. And the only response at that point in time that I can think of is, if you can talk to me, you can breathe, but if you stop struggling and you calm down, I'll relieve some pressure off of you.
He says he didn't have any information about what happened other than what he saw when he arrived. He says he felt it would have been a dangerous situation if Manny were able to get up.
The struggle that he was putting up with the two officers was very unsettling. So if he stood up, I didn't know if the fight was still on.
Soon, he says a lot of officers start arriving.
You could hear everyone kind of just slam their brakes, get out of the cars really quickly and run over to us.
Officer Burbank and other officers loop a hobble around Manny's ankles and cinch it to his handcuffs. Manny's legs are in the air. His knees are at least a 90-degree angle.
He was still thrashing around pretty hard. I remember specifically he was kicking his legs back from that 90-degree angle pretty hard, trying to almost like snap the hobble.
At this point, Rankin says he decided to do a weapon sweep on Manny. He gets down from the stand again to demonstrate to the jury how to do one. He says he took notice of Manny's condition.
His knuckles were really bloody. He had a lot of blood on his hands. When I was looking at his face, he had abrasions around his eyebrows, around his cheeks, and he was bleeding from his face. I think Officer Ford was still talking to him to calm down. I was telling him to calm down. And right as he was doing that, he started thrashing around again by kicking his legs back. So I instructed the other officers that were around me to just put him back on his stomach and reapply pressure.
He says Manny calms down again, so he tells all the officers to move Manny back to the recovery position on his side. By this time, he says his boss, Sergeant Michael Lim, had arrived and had taken control of the scene. Paramedics were there too, and they were getting ready to administer aid. Rankin says he wasn't ready to get off of Manny yet.
I wanted to voice it to fire that, hey, we just fought this guy. You want him out of cuffs and hobbles. There's a potential he could just fight all over again.
He says Lim gives the go-ahead, and the officers take the restraints off Manny. Manny dies shortly after that.
This whole incident was tragic. I don't think any of us sitting here thought he was going to die that night. But it happened. On a personal level, completely changed my life.
Rankin says he never saw Manny strike at Officer Collins or Burbank with any part of his body or threaten any officer on scene. Special Prosecutor Patty Eakes asks him about that moment when he heard Manny say he couldn't breathe. Rankin says by the time the medics got there, there wasn't much more for him to do.
And you never told fire when they arrived that Mr. Ellis had told you twice that he couldn't breathe, did you?
I did not. I was just busy trying to help fire.
You would agree that fire needs to understand what the situation is so that they can appropriately treat him, correct?
I think they started bagging him pretty quick when he got there.
So are you saying you didn't think you needed to tell him about Mr. Ellis saying he couldn't breathe?
I think in my mind, if he's getting air and he's getting bagged, I think if I just told him at that point in time that he stated previously that he can't breathe, I don't really know what it would have changed.
The officers say they followed their training that night. It was a dynamic situation, and they did their best to control the outcome. Officer Collins says it's a heavy burden that all officers carry.
In this case, undoubtedly, Manny was in the wrong. But at the end of the day, his mother lost a child and his sister lost a brother, and that human life is a precious thing. And so obviously it's a weight we bear as police officers when we go out and we step into this stuff every single night. But it's the worst possible outcome.
Six eyewitnesses tell stories about the interaction between Manny and the officers that cast a lot of doubt on the story the officers tell about Manny fighting them with superhuman strength. Some eyewitnesses say they saw the interaction from the beginning. They saw Manny walking casually down the sidewalk. They watched Manny walk over to the officer's patrol car and saw the officers get out and confront Manny. They watched the officers hit, choke, and tase him. They saw Manny struggle under the officer's weight. Some eyewitnesses say they heard Manny say he couldn't breathe. They all say Manny never fought back. Officer Collins says Manny could have just walked away and ignored them when they called him over to their patrol car. He says he and Officer Burbank would have just kept driving. But when Manny ran over to their patrol car and then punched the window and then threw Officer Collins into the street, they needed to arrest him. Manny was the aggressor. And because Manny wasn't complying, he was fighting them, they used more and more force to get him into handcuffs. Collins says Manny was still alive when backup arrived, and at that point, he and Officer Burbank let other officers continue to restrain him. Officer Rankin, who arrived as backup, says he didn't have any information, except for what he saw when he got on scene, that these two veteran officers were having a hard time getting Manny into handcuffs. He says even though Manny's hands and legs were restrained, Manny kept resisting and wouldn't calm down. He needed to continue to restrain him. And when paramedics arrived, he he says the paramedics were already treating Manny. Mentioning that he heard Manny say he couldn't breathe wouldn't have made a difference. The state alleges not only did the officers not have a justification to stop Manny that night, they didn't have to use as much force on him as they did. The state says audio and video evidence shows Manny pleading with the officers as they hit, tased, and choked him. The state says audio and video evidence shows Manny saying he couldn't breathe at least 5 times while officers ignored him or told him to shut up. They say officers Collins and Burbank left Manny on his stomach, beaten and hogtied, struggling to breathe. And when Rankin and other officers arrived as backup, they were more concerned about a potential threat against their colleagues than they were about Manny's well-being. They continued to hold Manny down, even when his hands were cuffed behind his back and connected to his legs. They continued to restrain Manny, even when he couldn't be a threat. The state says the officers were supposed to help Manny. They had a legal obligation to do so, and they didn't. Up next, we take a deep dive into the defense's strategy, and we hear what the science and the experts have to say about what happened on the night Manny died.
Mr. Ellis had a toxic and lethal amount of methamphetamine in his system.
It's him being beat up that's leading to his death.
Placing someone in the prone position is a very low likelihood of a bad outcome.
In my opinion, it was excessive at that point.
That's on part 2 of this episode of The Walk Home. You can find all of our reporting about the trial and this case at knkx.org/tpdtrial. This episode was reported by me, Mayowa Aina, KNKX reporter Jared Brown, and Seattle Times reporter Patrick Malone. It was written by me. Our executive producers are Florangela Davila and Jonathan Martin. They edited this episode with help from Amy Jeffries. We had research help from Miyoko Wolf. And music comes from Marcel E.C. Augustin, Will Jordan, and Quincy Q. Henry.